Bedtime Stories is produced in the Coastside Buzz Studios.
When Dinosaurs Came with Everything, written by Elise Broach, illustrated by David Small, published by Athenaeum Books for Young Readers in 2007. Friday is errand day, and my mom goes on boring errands, and I have to go with her. And this Friday seemed like every other Friday until we got to the bakery. A sign above the donuts read, "Buy a dozen, get a dinosaur." I couldn't believe my eyes, neither could my mom. "They must mean a toy," she said. But when I took the box of donuts, the lady behind the counter said, "Hold on, little guy, don't forget your dinosaur." And there he was. "Mom," I yelled. "It was a Triceratops." "What?" cried my mom. She did not look happy. "How are we supposed to get that home?" The bakery lady smiled. "Oh, don't worry. He'll follow you. They always do." And he did, all the way to the doctor's office where I had to go for my checkup. My mom shook her head. "What are we going to do with him now?" She looked him up and down. That took a while. "Well, we can't bring him inside," she said finally. "He'll have to stay in the parking lot." I told him not to talk to strangers. After my checkup, I asked for a sticker like usual. "Oh, no stickers today," said the nurse. "Just dinosaurs. With a shot, you get two." "Oh, I want a shot," I said. The nurse smiled. "Not today, buddy, but you can pick up your dinosaur at the front desk." "Mom," I yelled. There at the front desk was a stegosaurus. "What on earth is going on?" my mom cried. "It's a special day," the nurse explained. "Today, dinosaurs come with everything." "Yes," I said. "No," my mom groaned. We walked down the street, and my Triceratops and my Stegosaurus walked right behind us. Thud, thud, thud. They made friends right away. Across the street, other kids had dinosaurs, too. I saw an Ankylosaur, a Duckbill, and a Velociraptor. We all waved at each other. Our mothers glared and kept on walking. "I think we better go home right now," my mom said.
"But what about my haircut?
The barber's waiting for me." My mom looked at the dinosaurs. Then she looked at my bangs. "The barber always gives you a balloon, doesn't he? A nice balloon." "Uh-huh," I said. I didn't want a balloon. I wanted a barosaur. At the barber shop, I gave my Triceratops and my Stegosaurus donuts for a snack. They waited outside and watched through the glass. The barber pumped the chair up high. He cut my hair too short, but I didn't mind because he patted me on the head and said, "Wait right here, sport." He was gone for a long time. My mom tapped her foot. "I don't like this," she said. "Where exactly do they keep the balloons?" Just then, the barber came back with something flying over his head. It wasn't a balloon.
"Mom," I yelled, "it was a petrosaur."
"This is too much," my mom protested. "Now listen," she said to the barber. "I think a balloon will do just fine today. Don't you have any balloons?"
"Sorry, lady, no balloons. You get one of these instead."
It was like that everywhere we went. At the shoe store, the sign read, "Buy two pair, get dinosaur free." My mom decided my shoes would last a little while longer. At the theater, we could hear the popcorn man shouting,
"Butter, no butter. You want a dinosaur with that?"
My mom said we'd go to the movies another day. At the diner, I wanted to stop for a hamburger, but then a girl walked out with a Tyrannosaurus Rex. "Okay, that's it. We are definitely not having lunch there." She looked at my Triceratops, my Stegosaurus, and my Petrosaur. "What are we supposed to do with all of these dinosaurs? We don't have room for them. We can't take care of them." I hugged her leg. "Don't worry, Mom. They can live in the backyard." My mom shook her head. "Sweetheart, they are not toys. Dinosaurs are a lot of work. But Mom, look, they eat anything and they sleep outside. I'll do everything, I promise. Please, Mom, please. My mom sighed. Well, I suppose we can't just leave them here. Thank heavens we didn't stop at that diner. We hurried home, and my dinosaurs hurried after us. Thud, 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 flap, flap, flap. When we were almost there, we saw a little duck-billed dinosaur standing alone on the street corner. He looked lost. Mom, that's a baby hadrosaur. He's all by himself. Sweetie, we already have our hands full. The hadrosaur followed us. It wasn't my fault. Really? When we got home, my mom needed to lie down, so I made lunch for the dinosaurs. Then I showed them where to go to the bathroom. I told them to stay out of the neighbor's yard because of his mean dog. And I showed them my slide, my tire swing, and all the toys in the garage. They seemed to be having fun, but they really went wild when I took out my frisbee. The hadrosaur had the first throw. The frisbee landed on the roof. I saw my mom watching from the window. Is everything all right out there? Everything's fine, Mom. We can get it down. And my petrosaur flew up and plucked the frisbee out of the gutter. My mom kept watching. She looked at him for a long time. The next thing I knew, she had him cleaning the gutters. And then she came out to the backyard with a pile of wet clothes. These spikes come in handy, don't they? As she hung the clothes on the spikes. Pretty soon, my mom had thought of chores for all of my dinosaurs. But I knew they didn't mind. It just meant they were part of the family. When we were finished helping, my mom said I could invite some friends over. It was a bring-your-own-dinosaur party. And guess what happened next? I heard my mom on the phone to the bakery. She said, "Do you have any donuts left?" And that's when I knew everything would be just fine. Elise Broach lives with her family in rural Connecticut, where she writes books for children and teens, including Shakespeare's Secret and Wet Dog, and serves in town government. As a child, she made many journeys to the Dinosaur Hall of the American Museum of Natural History in New York City, and she returns often with her own children and her husband, who is a biologist there. When the next dinosaur day rolls around, she's hoping for a Diplodocus with her sandwich order at the deli. Visit Elise at www.elisebroach.com. That's B-R-O-A-C-H. David Small was awarded a Caldecott Medal for "So You Want to Be President?" by Judith St. George, and a Caldecott Honor for The Gardener by Sarah Stewart. He has illustrated many other books for children, including Once Upon a Banana by Jennifer Armstrong, The Christmas Crocodile by Bonnie Becker, The Library by Sarah Stewart, and his own Imogen's Antlers. He lives with his wife in Mendon, Michigan. He'd like to get an Apatosaurus with his next coffee purchase. Visit David at davidsmallbooks.com. When Dinosaurs Came with Everything was read by Michelle Dragony. Mr. Peabody's Apples by Madonna. Art by Lauren Long. The following message is from Madonna. This book was inspired by a nearly 300-year-old story that was told to me by my Kabbalah teacher. It is about the power of words and how we must choose them carefully to avoid causing harm to others. The Baal Shem Tov, the master of the good name, who was the author of the original story, was also a great teacher. He dedicated his life to helping others and stressed the value and importance of love for all people. I hope I have done his story justice.
This book is dedicated to teachers everywhere. Madonna.
Mr. Peabody's Apples is published by Scholastic, Inc. in 2003. In the town of Happyville, which wasn't a very big town, Mr. Peabody was congratulating his Little League team on a great game. They had not won, but no one really cared because they'd had such a good time playing. Mr. Peabody was the history teacher at the local elementary school, and in the summertime, he dedicated every Saturday to organizing baseball games with other schools. Billy Little, who wasn't a very big boy, was one of Mr. Peabody's students. He loved baseball more than anything, and he thought Mr. Peabody was the greatest. After each game, he would always stay to help pick up all the bats and balls, and when they were finished, Mr. Peabody would smile and say, "Thanks, Billy. Good job. I'll see you next Saturday." Then he would walk home along the main street of Happyville, waving hello to everyone he knew, and everyone would wave hello back. Along the way, he passed Mr. Funkadelli's fruit market. Here, Mr. Peabody would stop and admire Mr. Funkadelli's fresh apples. He would pick out the shiniest apple, drop it in his bag, and continue on his way. Across the street, Tommy Tittlebottom watched with curiosity as Mr. Peabody walked away with the apple. "That's strange," Tommy said to himself. "Mr. Peabody didn't pay anyone for that apple." Tommy got on his skateboard and rushed to tell his friends. The following Saturday, Mr. Peabody's team played another game, and they lost, as usual, but no one seemed to care because they had such a good time playing. Billy picked up the balls and bats, and Mr. Peabody set off on his walk home. He waved to everyone he knew, and they waved back. Once again, he stopped outside Mr. Funkadelli's fruit market, picked up the shiniest apple, dropped it in his bag, and continued on his way. Across the street, Tommy Tittlebottom and his friends watched Mr. Peabody, and they were amazed at what they saw. Mr. Peabody had not paid for his apple. They couldn't wait to tell all of their friends, who told their parents, who told their neighbors, who told their friends in the town of Happyville, which wasn't a very big town. The Saturday after that, Mr. Peabody was standing all alone on the baseball field, wondering where everybody was. Then he saw Billy walking toward him with a sad look on his face. "Hello, Billy. I'm glad you're here. But where is the rest of the team?" asked Mr. Peabody. Billy remained silent. "What is it, Billy?" he asked again. Billy didn't look up. "Everybody thinks you're a thief," he said to the ground. Mr. Peabody looked confused. He took off his hat and scratched his head. "Who says I'm a thief, Billy? And what did I steal?" he asked. "Tommy Tittlebottom and his friends said they saw you take an apple from Mr. Funkadelli's fruit market twice, and they said you didn't pay for them," answered Billy. "Ah," said Mr. Peabody, putting his hat back on his head. "Well, let's go talk to Mr. Funkadelli about it, shall we?" They walked down the main street, which wasn't a very big street, and Mr. Peabody waved to all the people he knew. But now some of them did not wave back, and some pretended they did not even see him. They finally arrived at Mr. Funkadelli's fruit market. Out popped Mr. Funkadelli, who said,
"Hey, what are you doing here, Mr. Peabody? Why aren't you at the game?"
"Well, there wasn't a game today," said Mr. Peabody, "and I was wondering if I could take my apple earlier than usual."
"Well, sure, why not?" replied Mr. Funkadelli. "You pay for them every Saturday morning when you pick up your milk. You can take them whenever you like. You want the big shiny one, Mr. Peabody?
Mr. Peabody took his apple, smiled, and offered it to Billy.
I would like to take the apple, Mr. Peabody, but I have to go and find Tommy and explain everything.
Well, when you find him, ask him to come over to my house.
I'd like to speak to him, too, replied Mr. Peabody.
A little while later, Billy found Tommy and told him what happened with the apples. He told Tommy that Mr. Peabody wanted to speak to him right away. So off Tommy ran, and when he arrived, he rang the doorbell, and Mr. Peabody came to the door. They looked at each other for a while.
Oh, Mr. Peabody, said Tommy on the doorstep. I didn't understand. I should not have said what I said, but it looked like you hadn't paid for the apples.
Mr. Peabody's eyebrows went up a little, and he felt a warm breeze blow across his face.
It doesn't matter what it looked like. What matters is the truth.
Tommy looked down at his shoes and said,
I am so sorry. What can I do to make things better now?
Mr. Peabody took a deep breath, looked up at a small cloud that was in the sky, and said,
I tell you what, Tommy, meet me at the baseball diamond in 1 hour and bring a pillow stuffed with feathers.
Okay, said Tommy, who ran off to his house to get a pillow.
An hour later, Tommy met Mr. Peabody on the pitcher's mound.
Hello, Tommy, said Mr. Peabody. Follow me and bring your pillow.
Tommy followed Mr. Peabody to the top of the bleachers, wondering what this was all about.
It's a windy day, isn't it?
Asked Mr. Peabody when they reached the top. Tommy nodded his head in agreement.
Here is a pair of scissors. Now cut the pillow in half and shake the feathers out.
Tommy looked confused, but did it anyway. He thought it was a small price to pay to gain Mr. Peabody's forgiveness. The wind carried the thousands of feathers far and wide. Tommy looked relieved and said,
Is that all I have to do to make things better? There is one more thing, said Mr. Peabody. Now you must go and pick up all of the feathers.
Tommy frowned.
I don't think it's possible to pick up all the feathers, Tommy replied.
It would be just as impossible to undo the damage that you have done by spreading the rumor that I'm a thief, said Mr. Peabody. Each feather represents a person in Happyville.
There was a long pause as Tommy began to understand what Mr. Peabody was saying. Finally, he said,
I guess I have a lot of work ahead of me.
Mr. Peabody smiled and said,
Indeed you do. Next time, don't be so quick to judge a person. And remember the power of your words.
Then he handed Tommy the shiny red apple and made his way home. The end. This is the second of 5 books for children, even grown-up ones, by Madonna, and illustrated by Lauren Long.
Mr. Peabody's Apples was recorded by Michelle Dragony. If you enjoyed listening to bedtime stories, you may enjoy reading it too. Buy the book at a local coastal bookstore.
The Cow Who Fell in the Canal by Phyllis Krasilovsky, illustrated by Peter Speer. Published by Edgemont in Britain in 1958. Hendrika was an unhappy cow. She lived on a farm in Holland where it is very flat. All summer long, she ate grass. All winter long, she ate hay. All winter and all summer, she did nothing but eat. And she gave milk to Mr. Hofstra, the farmer. Mr. Hofstra thought she was a fine cow because she gave such white, creamy milk. Eat, eat, Hendrika, he would say. The more you eat, the more creamy white milk you can give me. Hendrika
loved Mr. Hofstra, so she ate more to please him. But she was unhappy. In front of the pasture was a road. Every day Peter, the horse, came with a wagon to take Hendrika's milk to the city. Peter told Hendrika about the city.
"The streets are made of cobblestones, and the houses have staircases on their roofs, and people ride bicycles," he said.
Hendrika wanted to see the wonderful things Peter talked about. She was tired of looking at Mr. Hofstra's house and the barn and the windmill. The windmill wore a little porch. It went round and round in the wind. It made Hendrika dizzy. Behind the pasture, there was a narrow canal. In the summertime, a man came through the canal with a boat to take Mr. Hofstra's cheese to market. Hendrika liked the boats. She thought it would be nice to ride in a boat to market. Pieter said the cheese sellers wore colored straw hats with ribbons. Hendrika thought a colored hat would taste so good. Poor, unhappy Hendrika. She longed to see something besides the house, the barn, and the windmill. Instead, she ate and ate and ate, and she grew fat and then fatter and then very, very, very fat. She grew so fat she could hardly move. She grew so fat she could hardly see. One day, she went farther and farther and farther along the pasture. She looked neither right nor left, for she had only eyes for the sweet grass. And before she knew, she fell in the canal. The canal was not deep, but it was deep enough for Hendrika to get all wet. She was too fat to climb out, so she just stood in the water and ate the grass along the bank. Mr. Hofstra didn't know that Hendrika was in the canal because he was busy getting his cheese ready for market. Hendrika was in the canal for a long time. She ate so much grass that she became sleepy, but she couldn't sleep in the water. If only she could get back to the pasture. It was springtime, and there were flowers to eat. She walked and walked along the edge of the canal, eating grass, when suddenly she came upon an old raft. She pushed and pushed, and finally she fell on the raft, and it drifted away from the bank. Hendrika went floating down the canal. Past the pasture went Hendrika, past the barn, the house, and the windmill, past the tulips, past the neighbor's barn, house, and windmill, past more tulips, past another barn, another house, another windmill, still more tulips, and still another windmill. Now Hendrika wasn't too sleepy to open her eyes. There was so much to see on both sides of the canal. A whole row of houses with staircased roofs passed by. Then some children on bicycles. "Look at the cow on the canal!" they cried, and followed after on the road above the canal. Another row of staircased roofs passed by. Housewives were cleaning windows and scrubbing doorsteps. They laughed to see Hendrika floating along. They too followed along the banks, laughing and exclaiming. Soon a whole flock of people were running, walking, or riding along the bank, following the raft in the canal. Hendrika loved all the attention she was getting. She mooed with happiness. Suddenly, the raft stopped, and two boys pulled Hendrika to shore with a rope. Hendrika broke away and ran down the street. It was hard to run on the cobblestones, but Hendrika was enjoying the city at last. On and on through the streets she went, with all the people following her. She looked into windows and pranced into yards. She sniffed the bicycles. There was so much to see. Just as Hendrika began to get a little tired, she arrived at a big square. There were whole crowds of people. Here were men wearing colored straw hats with streamers. Here were balls of cheese piled high. The market was just as Pieter had told her it would be. And the green straw hat
tasted just as good as she thought it would.
Mr. Hofstra was there selling cheeses, too. "Hendrika," he cried when he saw her, "I thought you were at home in the pasture eating grass, not here eating hats. A hat is to wear." He was so surprised. Everyone laughed at his bewilderment. Mr. Hofstra put Hendrika in Pieter's wagon and drove her home. After that day, Mr. Hofstra made certain that Hendrika was safe in the pasture. Hendrika didn't mind. Now she had so much to think about as she chewed the grass, looking so pretty in a colored straw hat with streamers. The end.
The Cow Who Fell in the Canal was recorded by Michelle Dragony.
Mike Mulligan and His Steam Shovel. Story and pictures by Virginia Lee Burton. This was first published in 1939 by Houghton Mifflin Company out of New York, New York. Mike Mulligan had a steam shovel, a beautiful red steam shovel. Her name was Mary Ann. Mike Mulligan was very proud of Mary Ann. He always said that she could dig as much in a day as 100 men could dig in a week, but he had never been quite sure that this was true. Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann had been digging together for years and years. Mike Mulligan took such good care of Mary Ann, she never grew old. It was Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann and some others who dug the great canals for the big boats to sail through. It was Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann and some others who cut through the high mountains so that trains could go through. It was Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann and some others who lowered the hills and straightened the curves to make the long highways for the automobiles. It was Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann and some others who smoothed out the ground and filled in the holes to make the landing fields for the airplanes. And it was Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann and some others who dug the deep holes for the cellars of the tall skyscrapers in the big cities. When people used to stop and watch them, Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann used to dig a little faster and a little better. The more people stopped, the faster and better they dug. Some days, they would keep as many as 37 trucks busy taking away the dirt that they had dug. Then along came the new gasoline shovels and the new electric shovels and the new diesel motor shovels and took all the jobs away from the steam shovels. Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann were very sad. All the other steam shovels were being sold for junk or left out in old gravel pits to rust and fall apart. Mike loved Mary Ann. He couldn't do that to her. He had taken such good care of her that she could still dig as much in a day as 100 men could dig in a week. At least he thought she could, but he wasn't quite sure. Everywhere they went, the new gas shovels and the new electric shovels and the new diesel motor shovels had all the jobs. No one wanted Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann anymore. Then one day, Mike read in a newspaper that the town of Popperville was going to build a new town hall. "We're going to dig the cellar of that town hall," he said to Mary Ann, and off they started. They left the canals and the railroads and the highways and the airports and the big cities where no one wanted them anymore and went away out to the country. They crawled along slowly up the hills and down the hills till they came to the little town of Popperville. When they got there, they found that the selectmen were just deciding who should dig the cellar for the new town hall. Mike Mulligan spoke to Henry B. Swap, one of the selectmen. "I heard," he said, "that you're going to build a new town hall. Mary Ann and I will dig the cellar for you in just one day." "What?" said Henry B. Swap. "Dig a cellar in a day? It would take 100 men at least a week to dig a cellar for our new town hall." "Sure," said Mike. But Mary Ann can dig as much in a day as 100 men can dig in a week, though he had never been quite sure that this was true. Then he added, "If we can't do it, you won't have to pay." Henry B. Swap thought that this would be an easy way to get part of the cellar dug for nothing. So he smiled in a rather mean way and gave the job of digging the cellar of the new town hall to Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann. They started in early the next morning, just as the sun was coming up. Soon a little boy came along. "Do you think you'll finish by sundown?" he said to Mike Mulligan. "Sure," said Mike, "if you stay and watch us. We always work faster and better when someone is watching us." So the little boy stayed to watch. Then Mrs. McGillicuddy, Henry B. Swap, and the town constable came over to see what was happening, and they stayed to watch. Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann dug a little faster and a little better. This gave a little boy a good idea. He ran off and told the postman with the morning mail, the telegraph boy on his bicycle, the milkman with his cart and horse, the doctor on his way home, and the farmer and his family coming into town for the day. And they all stopped and stayed to watch. That made Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann dig a little faster and a little better. They finished the first corner, neat and square, but the sun was getting higher. Clang, clang, clang! The fire department arrived. They had seen the smoke and thought there was a fire. Then the little boy said, "Why don't you stay and watch?" So the fire department of Popperville stayed to watch Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann. When they heard the fire engine, the children in the school across the street couldn't keep their eyes on their lessons. The teacher called a long recess, and the whole school came out to watch. That made Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann dig a little faster and still better. They finished the second corner, neat and square, but the sun was right up in the top of the sky. Now the girl who answers the telephone called up the next towns of Bangerville and Bopperville and Kipperville and Copperville and told them what was happening in Popperville. All the people came over to see if Mike Mulligan and his steam shovel could dig the cellar in just one day. The more people came, the faster Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann dug. But they would have to hurry. They were only halfway through, and the sun was beginning to go down. They finished the third corner, neat and square. Never had Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann had so many people to watch them. Never had they dug so fast and so well. And never had the sun seemed to go down so fast. "Hurry, Mike Mulligan! Hurry, hurry!" shouted the little boy. "There's not much more time." Dirt was flying everywhere, and the smoke and steam were so thick that the people could hardly see anything. But listen! Bang, bang, crash, slam, louder and louder, faster and faster. Then suddenly it was quiet. Slowly the dirt settled down, and the smoke, steam cleared away. And there was the cellar, all finished. Four corners, neat and square. Four walls, straight down. And Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann at the bottom. And the sun was just going down behind the hill. "Hooray!" shouted the people. "Hooray for Mike Mulligan and his steam shovel. They have dug the cellar in just one day." Suddenly, the little boy said, "How are they going to get out?" "That's right," said Mrs. McGillicuddy to Henry B. Swap. "How is he going to get his steam shovel out?" Henry B. Swap didn't answer, but he smiled in a rather mean way. Then everybody said, "How are they going to get out? Hi, Mike Mulligan, how are you going to get your steam shovel out?" Mike Mulligan looked around at the four square walls and four square corners, and he said, "We've dug so fast and we've dug so well that we've quite forgotten to leave a way out." Nothing like this had ever happened to Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann before, and they didn't know what to do. Nothing like this had ever happened before in Popperville. Everybody started talking at once, and everybody had a different idea, and everybody thought that his idea was the best. They talked and they talked and they argued and they fought till they were worn out, and still no one knew how to get Mike Mulligan and Marianne out of the cellar they had dug. Then Henry B. Swap said, "Job isn't finished because Marianne isn't out of the cellar, and so Mike Mulligan won't get paid." And he smiled again, in a rather mean way. Now the little boy, who had been keeping very quiet, had another good idea. He said, "Why couldn't we have Marianne in the cellar and build the new town hall above her? Let her be the furnace for the new town hall, and let Mike Mulligan be the janitor. Then you wouldn't have to buy a new furnace, and we could pay Mike Mulligan for digging the cellar in just one day." "Why not?" said Henry B. Swap, and smiled in a way that was not quite so mean. "Why not?" said Mrs. McGillicuddy. "Why not?" said the town constable. "Why not?" said all the people. So they found a ladder and climbed down into the cellar to ask Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann. "Why not?" said Mike Mulligan. So it was decided, and everybody was happy. They built the new town hall right over Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann. It was finished before winter. Every day the little boy goes over to see Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann, and Mrs. McGillicuddy takes him nice hot apple pies. As for Henry B. Swap, he spends most of his time in the cellar of the new town hall listening to the stories that Mike Mulligan has to tell and smiling in a way that isn't mean at all. Now, when you go to Popperville, be sure to go down in the cellar of the new town hall. There they'll be, Mike Mulligan and Mary Ann. Mike in his rocking chair smoking his pipe and Mary Ann beside him, warming up the meetings in the new town hall. The end.
Mike Mulligan's Steam Shovel was recorded with Cherise McHugh, CEO of the Half Moon Bay Chamber of Commerce. Mike Mulligan's Steam Shovel was her son's favorite book, and now Cherise reads it to his kids. If you enjoyed listening to this bedtime story, you may enjoy reading it too. Buy it at a local coastal bookstore like Inkspell Books in Half Moon Bay.
Good Night Moon by Margaret Wise Brown, published by Harper Trophy in 1947. In the great green room, there was a telephone and a red balloon and a picture of the cow jumping over the moon. And there were three little bears sitting on chairs and two little kittens and a pair of mittens and a little toy house and a young mouse, and a comb, and a brush, and a bowl full of mush, and a quiet old lady who was whispering, "Hush. Good night, room. Good night, moon. Good night, cow jumping over the moon. Good night, light and the red balloon. Good night, bears. Good night, chairs. Good night, kittens, and good night, mittens. Good night, clocks, and good night, socks. Good night, little house, and good night, mouse. Good night, comb, and good night, brush. Good night, nobody. Good night, mush. And good night to the old lady whispering, hush. Good night, stars. Good night, air. Good night noises everywhere."
Good Night Moon was recorded on February 13th, 2016 by Mary Corcoran of Half Moon Bay Coastside Tours, reading for her grandson, Ollie. The Star and the Ocean is an original story written and illustrated by local preschool teacher and artist Tyler Nelson. It was recorded on February 16th. 2016 in Tyler's own voice. Enjoy the illustration she drew at the request of her Holy Family preschool students.
When the sky was born, and there was only night, there were many stars. A golden star that hung in the sky saw the ocean. The ocean was more beautiful than anything the star had ever seen, and the golden star fell in love with the ocean. The world and the star got older and older. The star saw the ocean's waves roar with wind and rain. Some nights the ocean was peaceful, and the star could see its golden reflection. For a very long time, the star watched the ocean, and it felt deeply in love. One day, the star went to the moon and said, "I have to be with the ocean. We can't live apart." The moon laughed at the star and said, "A star can't love the ocean because they would have nowhere to live." The golden star returned to its spot in the sky. Every day after, the star was more and more unhappy, and its light got weaker and weaker until it almost went out. The golden star missed the ocean with all of its heart. The moon watched the golden star sadly. It didn't want it to be so unhappy. Watching the star's light almost go out, it had to help. The moon snuck up behind the star and cut its string to the sky. The golden star fell through the sky towards the ocean, so happy to be free. Faster and faster the star fell to the dark water below, until, with a smile and a happy sigh, the golden star sank into the water and disappeared. Watching from the sky, the moon began to worry. It couldn't see the star. The moon was patient and watched the sparkling water until at last there was a spark. The golden star rose in all its glory as the sun. In the light of the first sunrise, small pools by the ocean shore were covered with colorful star-shaped fish. The ocean, touching the face of the sun as it slowly rose, said, "These are our children of star and sea, and they will always have a place to live."
The end. Bedtime Stories is produced in the Coastside Buzz Studios. Sheep in a Jeep was recorded by the Coastal Butterfly on June 22nd, 2016. If you enjoyed listening to this bedtime story, you may enjoy reading it too. Buy the book at a local coastal bookstore. Sheep in a Jeep by Nancy Shaw, illustrated by Margot Apple, and published by Houghton Mifflin Company, Boston, in 1986. I'm reading this story for my friend Harry the Y, producer of Coastside Buzz's Coastside Musicians, whose Jeep was a heap this week.
Meet, meet. Sheep in a Jeep on a hill that's steep.
Uh-oh. The Jeep won't go.
Sheep leap to push the Jeep.
Sheep shove. Sheep grunt.
Sheep don't think to look up front. Jeep goes splash.
Jeep goes thud. Jeep goes deep in gooey mud.
Sheep tug.
Sheep shrug.
Sheep yelp.
Sheep get help.
Jeep comes out.
Sheep shout.
Sheep cheer.
Oh dear.
The driver sheep forgets to steer.
Jeep in a heap.
Sheep weep. Sheep sweep the heap.
Jeep for sale.
Jeep. The end.
Bedtime Stories is produced in the Coastside Buzz Studios.
Love You Forever was recorded by Mary Corcoran of Half Moon Bay Coastside Tours, reading for her first grandson, Ollie. If you enjoyed listening to this bedtime story, you may enjoy reading it too. Buy the book at a local coastal bookstore.
Love You Forever, written by Robert Munch, illustrated by Sheila McGraw, published by Firefly Books in 1986. A mother held her new baby and very slowly rocked him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And while she held him, she sang, "I'll love you forever. I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be. I'll
love you forever. I'll like you for always.
The baby grew. He grew and he grew and he grew. He grew until he was 2 years old, and he ran all around the house. He pulled all the books off the shelves. He pulled all the food out of the refrigerator, and he took his mother's watch and flushed it down the toilet. Sometimes his mother would say, "This kid is driving me crazy." But at nighttime, when that 2-year-old was quiet, she opened the door to his room, crawled across the floor, looked up over the side of his bed, and if he was really asleep, she picked him up and rocked him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. While she rocked him, she sang, "I'll love you forever. I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be." The little boy grew. He grew and he grew and he grew. He grew until he was 9 years old. And he never wanted to come in for dinner. He never wanted to take a bath. And when Grandma visited, he always said bad words. Sometimes his mother wanted to sell him to the zoo. But at nighttime, when he was asleep, the mother quietly opened the door to his room, crawled across the floor, and looked up over the side of the bed. If he was really asleep, she picked up that 9-year-old boy and rocked him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And while she rocked him, she sang, "I love you forever. I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be." The boy grew. He grew and he grew and he grew. He grew until he was a teenager. He had strange friends, and he wore strange clothes, and he listened to strange music. Sometimes his mother felt like she was in a zoo. But at nighttime, when that teenager was asleep, the mother opened the door to his room, crawled across the floor, and looked up over the side of the bed. If he really was asleep, she picked up that great big boy and rocked him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. While she rocked him, she sang, "I'll love you forever. I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby you'll be." That teenager grew. He grew and he grew and he grew. He grew until he was a grown-up man. He left home and got a house across town. But sometimes on dark nights, the mother got into her car and drove across town. If all the lights in her son's house were out, she opened his bedroom window, crawled across the floor, and looked up over the side of his bed. If that great big man was really asleep, she picked him up and rocked him back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And while she rocked him, she sang. Well, that mother got older. She got older and older and older. One day, she called up her son and said, "You'd better come see me because I'm very old and sick." So her son came to see her. When he came in the door, she tried to sing the song. She sang, "I love you forever. I like you for always." But she couldn't finish because she was too old and sick.
the son went to his mother. He picked her up and rocked her back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And he sang this song. I'll love you forever. I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my mommy you'll be. When the son came home that night, he stood for a long time at the top of the stairs. Then he went into the room where his very new baby daughter was sleeping. He picked her up in his arms and very slowly rocked her back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. And while he rocked her, he sang, I'll love you forever. I'll like you for always. As long as I'm living, my baby, you'll be.
And that was Love You Forever, sung by Mary Corcoran on Bedtime Stories.
You Give a Mouse a Cookie by Laura Joffe Numeroff. Illustrated by Felicia Bond. Published by HarperCollins Publishers, 1985. If you give a mouse a cookie, he's going to ask for a glass of milk. When you give him the milk, he'll probably ask you for a straw. When he's finished, he'll ask you for a napkin. Then he'll want to look in a mirror to make sure he doesn't have a milk mustache. When he looks in the mirror, he might notice his hair needs a trim, so he'll probably ask for a pair of nail scissors. When he's finished giving himself a trim, he'll want a broom to sweep it up. He'll start sweeping. He might get carried away and sweep every room in the house. He may even end up washing the floors as well. When he's done, he'll probably want to take a nap. You'll have to fix up a little box for him with a blanket and a pillow. He'll crawl in, make himself comfortable, and fluff the pillow a few times. He'll probably ask you to read him a story. So you'll read to him from one of your books, and he'll ask to see the pictures. When he looks at the pictures, he'll get so excited he'll want to draw one of his own. He'll ask for paper and crayons. He'll draw a picture. When the picture is finished, he'll want to sign his name with a pen. Then he'll want to hang his picture on your refrigerator, which means he'll need scotch tape. He'll hang up his drawing and stand back to look at it. Looking at the refrigerator will remind him that he's thirsty, so he'll ask for a glass of milk. And chances are, if he asks you for a glass of milk, he's going to want a cookie to go with it. The end. Thanks for listening to Bedtime Stories on Coastside Buzz.
Bedtime Stories is produced in the Coastside Buzz Studios.
How the Grinch Stole Christmas by Dr. Seuss. Random House, New York. 1957. Every who down in Whoville liked Christmas a lot, but the Grinch, who lived just north of Whoville, did not. The Grinch hated Christmas the whole Christmas season. Now please don't ask why. No one quite knows the reason. It could be his head wasn't screwed on just right. It could be, perhaps, that his shoes were too tight. But I think the most likely reason of all may have been that his heart was two sizes too small. But whatever the reason, his heart or his shoes, he stood there on Christmas Eve hating the Whos, staring down from his cave with his sour, grinchy frown at the warm, lighted windows below in their town. for he knew every Who down in Whoville beneath was busy now, hanging a mistletoe wreath. "And they're hanging their stockings," he snarled with a sneer. "Tomorrow is Christmas. It's practically here." Then he growled with his Grinch fingers nervously drumming. I must find some way to stop Christmas from coming. For tomorrow, he knew, all the Who girls and boys would wake bright and early. They'd rush for their toys. And then, oh, the noise. And that's one thing he hated, the noise. Then the Whos, young and old, would sit down to a feast, and they'd feast, and they'd feast, and they'd feast, then they'd feast, feast, feast. They would feast on Who pudding and rare Who roast beast, which was something the Grinch couldn't stand in the least. And then they do something he liked least of all. Every Who down in Whoville, the tall and the small, would stand close together with Christmas bells ringing. They'd stand hand in hand, and the Whos would start singing. And they'd sing, and they'd sing, and they'd sing, 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 sing. And the more the Grinch thought of this Who Christmas sing, the more the Grinch thought, I must stop this whole thing. Why, for 53 years I've put up with it now. I must stop this Christmas from coming. But how? Then he got an idea. An awful idea. The Grinch got a wonderful, awful idea. I know just what to do. The Grinch laughed in his throat, and he made a quick Santa Claus hat and a coat, and he chuckled and clucked. What a great Grinchy trick! With this coat and this hat, I look just like Saint Nick, and all I need is a reindeer. The Grinch looked around, but since reindeer are scarce, there was none to be found. But did that stop the old Grinch? No! The Grinch simply said, if I can't find a reindeer, I'll make one instead. So he called his dog Max. Then he took some red thread and he tied a big horn on top of his head. Then he loaded some bags and some old empty sacks on a ramshackle sleigh and he hitched up old Max. Then the Grinch said, get up! And the sleigh started down toward the homes where the Whos lay a snooze in their town. All their windows were dark. Quiet snow filled the air. All the Whos were dreaming sweet dreams without care. When he came to the first little house on the square, this is stop number one, the old Grinchy Claus hissed. And he climbed to the roof, empty bags in his fist. Then he slid down the chimney, a rather tight pinch. But if Santa could do it, then so could the Grinch. He got stuck only once for a moment or two. Then he stuck his head out of the fireplace flue. Where the little Who stockings were all in a row. These stockings, he grinned, are the first things to go. Then he slithered and slunk with a smile most unpleasant around the whole room, and he took every present. Popguns and bicycles, roller skates, drums, checkerboards, tricycles, popcorn, and plums, and he stuffed them in bags. Then the Grinch very nimbly stuffed all the bags one by one up the chimbley. Then he slunk to the icebox, where he took the Who's feast. He took the Who pudding. He took the roast beast. Then he cleaned out that icebox as quick as a flash. Why, that Grinch even took their last can of Who hash. Then he stuffed all the food up the chimney with glee. "And now," grinned the Grinch, "I will stuff up the tree." And the Grinch grabbed the tree and he started to shove when he heard a small sound like the coo of a dove. He turned around fast and he saw a small Who, little Cindy Lou Who, who was not more than 2. The Grinch had been caught by this tiny Who daughter who'd got up out of bed for a cup of cold water. She stared at the Grinch and said, "Santa Claus, why? Why are you taking our Christmas tree? Why?" But you know, that old Grinch was so smart and so slick, he thought up a lie, and he thought it up quick. "Why, my sweet little tot," the fake Santy lied, "there's a light on this tree that won't light up on one side. So I'm taking it home to my workshop, my dear. I'll fix it up there. Then I'll bring it back here." And his fib fooled the child. Then he patted her head, and he got her a drink, and he sent her to bed. And when Cindy Lou Who went to bed with her cup, he went to the chimney and stuffed the tree up. Then the last thing he took was the log for their fire. Then he went up the chimney himself, the old liar. On their walls he left nothing but hooks and some wire. And the one speck of food that he left in the house was a crumb that was even too small for a mouse. Then he did the same thing to the other Who houses, leaving crumbs much too small for the other Who mouses. It was 1:15, all the Who's still abed, all the Who's still a snooze. When he packed it up with their presents, the ribbons, the wrappings, the tags and the tinsel, the trimmings, the trappings, 3,000 feet up the side of Mount Crumpet, he rode with his load to the tip-top to dump it. "Pooh, pooh to the Who's," he was Grinchishly humming. "They're finding out now that no Christmas is coming. They're just waking up. I know just what they'll do. Their mouths will hang open a minute or two. Then the Who's in Whoville will all cry, boo, hoo." "That's a noise," grinned the Grinch, "that I simply must hear." So he paused, and the Grinch put his hand to his ear, and he did hear a sound rising over the snow. It started low, then it started to grow. But the sound wasn't sad. Why, the sound sounded merry. It couldn't be so. But it was merry. Very. He stared down at Whoville. The Grinch popped his eyes. Then he shook. What he saw was a shocking surprise. Every Who down in Whoville, the tall and the small, was singing, without any presents at all. He hadn't stopped Christmas from coming. It came. Somehow or other, it came just the same. And the Grinch, with his Grinch feet ice cold in the snow, stood puzzling and puzzling. How could it be so? It came without ribbons. It came without tags. It came without packages, boxes, or bags. And he puzzled 3 hours till his puzzler was sore. Then the Grinch thought of something he hadn't before. Maybe Christmas, he thought, doesn't come from a store. Maybe Christmas, perhaps, means a bit more. And what happened then? Well, in Whoville, they say that the Grinch's small heart grew 3 sizes that day. And the minute his heart didn't feel quite so tight, he whizzed with his load through the bright morning light. And he brought back the toys and the food for the feast. And he himself, the Grinch, carved the roast beast. The end.